Well, it's time for our regular chat with Mr. Ken Bates, and he joins us right now. Good morning, KB.
Good morning.
How are you?
Well, how's the weather in Leeds?
Yeah, it's not good. Not good. It's been a bit pants this week.
So the pitch at Elland Road will be nice and green.
Yeah, they won't have a trouble with watering the pitch at the moment, that's for sure. plenty to talk with, as always, KB. Let's start with Leeds United. And there's been a few changes here and there over the course of this summer. And, of course, as we know, Neil Redfern has departed now. And of course, Lucy Ward has departed. And you wanted to say some bits and pieces about sort of the work Lucy's done at Elland Road.
Yes, I'm very sorry to hear that Lucy had gone. But it was, I suppose, inevitable once Neil Redfern left as well. But I regard both, I mean, at the end of the day, the management and ownership decide what they want. But I think those two were big losses. One of the reasons why they're both losses, Redford could certainly find the players and coach them. But Lucy did an unsung heroine behind the scenes. Lucy was a former England international footballer. She looked after the kids. She was responsible for their education, which is now required as part of the football's training. You know, you don't bring kids in and chuck them out again. Well, some clubs do, but for different reasons. But she was responsible for ensuring that the kids had good discipline and had a good education. And in fact, she always send us, Suzanne and I, the results of the kids' exams, and they all did, on the whole, did pretty well, well above average. The point being that no matter how good you are, each year, one in 10 of you might make it. The other nine are going to have to find an alternative career. And when they left Leeds, if they'd been unsuccessful, they went with a good education and the ability to do well for themselves in life. And that, of course, the parents liked. And that's one of the attractions, getting youngsters to Leeds, which is why we had such a good conveyor belt of youngsters coming through and who are still coming through. I just hope that under the new regime, details of which we know not, that doesn't stop. Because most Yorkshire kids want to play for Leeds United. It's the biggest county in the country outside London. And it gives a great catchment area, which the club should be taking advantage of. So I don't know who Messinger has brought in to replace them, but they're going to have to start all over from scratch, which is a pity. But I'm sure Lucy would do well, because she has undoubted talent. And I'm sure Neil Redfern would do well as well. I just hope that we don't look back in the future, if you know what I mean, to regret that those two parted.
Some other news as well from Elland Road KB, which was something that you pointed out in the Yorkshire Post about...
Yorkshire Evening Post.
The Yorkshire Evening Post, which is some disappointment because one of the things during your reign at Elland Road was earmarked for a club museum. There was space on the East End for a club museum, but that's now been taken up not by a museum but by a firm of solicitors.
Well, I can understand what Massimo's trying to do, and obviously, and Pearson's trying to do, and that is, you have to maximise non-match day income. I mean, go back a bit. It's always been my philosophy. I know fans say, "Oh, why didn't somebody put another 20 million?" But sure, I say, why should they? The club should be run on proper business lines, which, for example, Manchester United are doing. Interesting to note that Manchester United are one of the most successful clubs in the world, and none of the owners, I knew them all, Louis Edwards, Martin Edwards, and then the Lerners, never put a penny in Manchester United. They generated the funds out of the club by running out of business, and that's what I've always done, and that was the intention at Leeds. But you have to be longer term planning. When we did the East End, there was quite a bit of spare space, which we created specifically for a museum. Because Leeds is the only major club in the country that hasn't got a museum. Even small clubs have got museums. And Leeds have nothing. And of course, they have a very long industrious history. And we've got plenty of mementos and artifacts to back it up. And we recruited this lady from the Bolton Armouries to come across and start working on our plan for a museum, there's lots of equipment about. Don't know where it is now, of course. And the plans was that we were going to do it just above the East End main entrance, very big ones. They're all designed in some detail. We even got to the East End getting prices for doing the work. But of course, the long drawn out takeover negotiations with the Arabs, all that kind of stuff had to be put on hold. And so they took over in 21st December 2012. And Suzanne and I thought about the museum hadn't been done. And we came up with the idea, we were attending the Football League annual conference in Portugal, and it was arranged, we sat down and talked to Sean Harvey, and we wrote a letter, an offer, to the Arabs, Geo Fates. Of course, and there, by that time we had no financial interest in the club. What we said was that we, Suzanne and I, would pay for the cost of installing the museum. We thought it would cost £1.25 million. And then it would be run, and all the profits would go to the League United Foundation, which, as if you remember, was sort of set up and expanded during my reign. It's basically, it does good works around the greater Leeds area. And Sean, we sat down, hammered out the deal. Sean had made in the offer and sent it off to Geofates. Do you know why Leeds United haven't got a museum today?
I'm sure you're going to tell me.
Because the Arabs didn't even acknowledge the letter. So I could understand Massimo selling all this spare space we don't need, let's let it and get an income in, and I understand that. But just imagine if we'd have had a museum. First of all, Leeds is on the road to York and Edinburgh, and hundreds of thousands of foreign tourists every year tour England by coach, and they stop off at York because York is a famous historic city, on the way to Edinburgh. But in view of my connections and history in the tourist industry, we could have got those coaches to stop off at Ellen Road on the way. Now, first of all, of course, they would go around the museum, and that would, even at a bulk discount price, a lot of money. But then we could arrange to feed them at Ellen Road, then take them to the Megastore. So Leeds United and the foundation got three separate sources of income. The foundation got the money from the profit from the museum. The club got all the profit from selling snacks and meals. And the club got all the profit from the huge increased sales of merchandise in the megastore. But it's more important than that, because these, say, 100,000 to 300,000 people a year that come to Ellen Road from overseas, when they go back home, they then start, many of them will adopt Leeds United as their second club. So you'll get a continuing stream of club merchandise being purchased. They'll watch LUTV and they'll watch all the Leeds information on the internet. Some of them will subscribe for programmes on an annual basis. Think all that money that is going to come in. I've just been looking, as an illustration, but looking at Chelsea's plans for improving the ground, or rebuilding it. And one of the points they've made, at the moment, they have a museum and a visitor attraction. At the moment, they get 2 million people a year in on non-match days. They expect, as a result of this redevelopment, They get 4 million people a year on match days, on non-match days. Because, of course, at Elland Road, not only will we get the foreign visitors, but we get all the English fans and English tourists as well. Now, just imagine if we'd only got 500,000 visitors a year to Elland Road, how much that would have been worth to the club. Every year, on a growing basis, money coming into the club to invest in new players, enhance the academy, all that's lost because there's idiots in Bahrain didn't know what they were doing from start to finish. Interesting, cutting out my files, I read an interesting email which was given to me by David Haig, which the great Dave Cooper sent to GFH, offering them all his help and that of Lust to assist them in getting rid of me and taking over the club. There's one phrase I felt very amused about, and in fact I'm just walking to the next room to get it because I know exactly where it is. I think you'll be amused by it.
Okay.
It's on the 31st of August 2012. From Gary Cooper, sub to Leeds United Supporters Fed representation. From Gary Cooper. Hello, David Haig. I'm sorry to run the money bombarding you right now, but my contract is a genuine offer from the Leeds United Supporters Trust, now close to 8,000, which of course wasn't true, because if you just logged onto their website, you became a member. We are all looking forward at last to a Leeds United whose owners share the same ambition as the fans. Now, who is the sucker and who is the conman? Well, they got their desire for change. They got their change. And it's now 2015, nearly three years after Mr. Cooper sent that message. They went to Injazat Capital, Arrow sent up. David Hayes sent it with a note, so I thought you might be interested in this, Ken. So, getting back to the mainstream, what a missed opportunity. Because now, thinking aloud now, I don't think there's any room left at Elland Road where you could build a museum now. Well, you'd have to build the building as well, which would greatly increase the cost. And Leeds United could have had it for nothing. So we haven't got a museum, and we've lost two very valuable members of the backroom staff. All we can do is wish their successors the very best.
Talking of other things at Leeds United, a former player, Max Gradle, who's a bit of a fan's favourite, really.
He's a great player.
Left to go
great
to
very fast, very quick.
Looks like he's going
a
to...
A war of expectancy used to go up around the ground whenever he got the ball.
Looks like he's off to Bournemouth. He was on loan there for a while. Looks like he's going to go off to Bournemouth for maybe a fee on that coming to Leeds as well. What were the circumstances for his departure? Because I know a number of fans were upset when he left to go to St Etienne. I think he was player of the season that year. What were the circumstances of his departure?
I'll tell you the full story. It was told at the time, but I don't think he's picked up in the way perhaps he should have been. Max Grade was a good young player. We picked him up fairly cheaply, I think. And he blossomed with us and did well. But he was French. Obviously, his ethnic origin was black. Obviously, he came via the French African colonies. But he was basically French. And I think it was the year we just missed out on promotion or playoffs or something. And his agent came to see us. And unlike some agents, I'd like to put in a vat of boiling oil, this man was quite reasoned. He explained, Matt was French, and his origins and family were in France. And he had an opportunity to go to Saint-Étienne. Now, they're, how would you describe them? They're outside the four, but they're a significant rural club. And they just qualified for Europe, Champion League. So there was this kid who had the chance to get to his own country, take a very significant club and play in the European Champions League rather than playing in the Championship. I think that 2 or 3 years on his contract. Took it at 100. The agent said, please, will you sell him? We'll get you a good price. But will you sell him to enable this boy to try and achieve his ambitions? And quite frankly, I suppose we could have said, no, you can't go. Had an unhappy player. But as you weep, as you sow, so you reap. And we've always been tried to be good to our players, whichever club I've been at. Because that way you attract more players in. So we blessed him, wished him well, sold him to Saint-Étienne, so much down, and so much later. And in fact, knowing subsequently, know about the problems of getting money from Europe when he sold players on the Never Never, was a bit apprehensive, and all organised to collect the money if necessary. The second instalment came from a due date without even a reminder. So Étienne were a great club to deal with. So Max went to a great club. And they did play in the Champions League. And he took part in it. But he never really established himself. He was always a squad player, not the number one. Which I was always sorry for him. Because he deserved better. So now he's come back to England, Bournemouth. And he'll play in the Premiership. And let's hope that while he's still playing at Bournemouth, we'll see him at Elland Road in the Premier League sooner rather than later. I wish him well. Great little player. My memory until my dying day of being Max being sent off unfairly when we played Bristol Rovers and won automatic promotion back to the Championship. And he was sent off twice, once for the alleged foul, which I think was unfair. Secondly, because he refused to go. Remember, in the end, somebody picked him up and carried him kicking and struggling off the side. We're one goal down with a quarter now to go. Then we got our 2 goals, which took us up.
It was an amazing day.
Wayne Beckford and Tony Housman got the 2 goals. So I'd be surprised if we get any more money for Max, because we think we've got $7 million plus for him. And if, as you say, I haven't seen it yet, they've Bournemouth paid him good for $5 million, then there wouldn't be any add-ons. But it's an interesting story, and a nice one, actually, from Leeds' point of view.
Yeah, it would be great to see Max Gradle back in English football, it really would. Moving on, just away from Leeds United, KB, and talk, this is from just a few weeks ago, that Greg Dyke is now backing the Hull Tigers name change. And obviously fans are up in arms. They don't want their club's name to be changed. Just wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Well, mixed thoughts. I mean, some were well and some have been total failure. Some years ago, I mean, Leighton Orient used to be called Clapton Orient. Clapton is a suburb of East London, and Orient, I don't know why somebody called Argyle or somebody called Thistle or Villa, we don't know. Anyway, I remember remember the then chairman thought he wanted to make it a bit more, to change the name to the Orient. But it didn't really work. Mind you, they were rather small club anyway. And the subsequent chairman changed it, but not to Captain Orient, to Leighton Orient, which is more modern. And you hear Leighton today, you don't hear Clapton. So I'm not sure that did very much for them. And then you have, in the old days, you have Bournemouth and Boscombe Athletic. Boscombe being a suburb of Bournemouth, by the way. Lytham St Annes is a suburb of Blackpool. It didn't really work. And they changed its name to AFC Bournemouth, which sort of trips off the tongue and didn't have any adverse effects. Arsenal used to call Woolwich Arsenal. Queen's Park Rangers used to call St Jude's Institute because it was a school in northwest London. But players are emotive about, fans are emotive about names. This is an unusual one at Hull. So it's not a question of an overseas guy coming in and taking over a club, chucking his money about and then wanting to make an impression in his homeland. The present owner has, of course, he's an Egyptian. His family came 50-odd years ago, 40-odd years ago, and has got involved very heavily in Hull. He's now a very respected, successful businessman. And when Hull was on difficulties, he took it over and turned it around. Assisted, I think, by Adam Pearson, our current chief executive, or managing director, what they call them these days. But, so Mr. Pearson will know more about it than most. But he has done a very good job. But the point he's making, like the owners wanting to change the name, the point he's making is that more and more English football are being watched in the Orient, which has a huge market and there's huge commercial activities there, which means in shirt selling and so on, as I've talked earlier about Leeds. So he wants to change it to Tigers because Tiger is a symbol of strength and success in Asia. But the name is Hull City. But there's a complication here, because even when I was 40 years ago, I can remember going to Hull when they won promotion from the old third division. 30,000 people there that night. And of course, what is their club song? It's Hold That Tiger. It's been a very popular tune in the 50s. I'm not going to sing it over the phone and spoil people's day. But it's a very jingoistic, go for it, macho type of song. Very different to You'll Never Walk Alone, the one that Liverpool adopted. So there is this Tiger connotation, so I can see where the man's coming from. I don't know, actually. I know I'm sitting on the fence on this one, but I can see both sides of the argument. And since I'm not the Hull supporter, I'm loath to pass come. I can see both points of the argument, but on the other hand, you have to move with the times. Don't forget, Caledon Thistle in Scotland is a merger of two clubs. And you nearly had Fulham Park Rangers in London. And Bob Maxwell wanted to merge Reading and Oxford and call them Thames Valley Royals. Well, that didn't go to anything either. I can understand the fans' point of view. I can understand the owner's point of view. Wants to maximise commercial opportunities, but who knows? Greg Dyke will have reservations about Mr. Dyke of old, but that's for another time.
Let's just get finally, KB, your thoughts on Michel Platini. Looks like he's going to be in line to succeed Sepp Blatter, it seems.
Well, Platini, don't know a lot about him. I do remember in 1988, when the Football League had their centenary celebrations, the league organised a English League versus European League match at Wembley, which was an ill-conceived idea. It was unfortunately asked me to look at, take over and organise, which I did. And we've got Terry Venables as one of the managers. And Platini was one of the players invited to play for European leagues. I think it was a pulsating 0-0 draw or something. Platini sent his invite. We asked all the overseas players to give us their expenses. And you know, as they came in, we paid them. So that was for Mr. Platini, about £5,500. I mean, this was 30-odd years ago, for use of his private jet, which we rejected and gave him the equivalent of two first-class Air France tickets. So he likes the good life. He liked the good life even those days. So let's just hope he... mind you, whatever he does at FIFA, he must be more temperate than Mr. Blatter. But he has been close to Blatter for some time. So it'd be interesting to see if he does become the president, as it looks likely, how far or how wide he opens the Pandora's box, and let all the stuff come out so we know what's going on. Or would it be a measured handover to keep a lot of things hidden? Hope not. On the other hand, some of the other alternatives, names with Arabs with indescribable names, don't know how they get them on their visiting cards or even put it on the top of their notepaper. We don't think we want anything to do with the Middle East or the Gulf running FIFA. We've got anybody from Africa running FIFA. We don't want anything from South America running FIFA. So that narrows the loads a bit. So maybe Mr. Platini will be a relatively safe pair of hands. Anything will be to improve Mr. Blatter, who, of course, is so discourteous, he hasn't even acknowledged Sam's job offer last week, which I think is a bit discourteous. You think that if he's going to want to get return to the communications business, first thing you think was he'd communicate. And the second thing, if he had a better job offer, well, you think he'd be proud enough to boast about it.
It's a good offer as well, free accommodation and everything.
But, well, there you are, that's right. But you can never tell, can you, these days? Just one final point. I see that in the same article about the solicitors moving into Ellen Road, other one, Mr. Robinson. Perhaps it was edited out. But he finishes up saying that about my tenure at Ellen Road, I was due to sound president for further 3 years, actually it was 2 years, but lasted 25 days before being sacked. For the, I'm sure Mr. Robinson wants to tell a fair story. And the full truth of the matter is, of course, that the Arabs, Mrs. Patel and Hisham, want to get rid of everybody. In fact, we have copies of correspondence where they're trying to find some reason to sack Gwyn Williams, which they did. Sean Harvey, trying to dodge paying him his bonus, which he's entitled to do. That failed. And they did it with me. And then sued me. The ultimate end of that story was that They failed in their case against me. They ran up over £500,000 in legal costs, which Leeds had to pick up. They weren't my legal costs. They were their own legal costs from Gibson Dunn, the people who are prosecuting, or were allegedly prosecuting, David Hay in Dubai. And, of course, went to mediation, which we agreed. A mediation is whereby two sides of the court case get together, try and agree the deal without going to court. And we agreed a deal with David Hay, who was confirmed had the authority to do the deal. Then, of course, the Arabs probably reneged on it. When Massimo Cellino came in on the 1st of August, met me for the first time at Dorchester Bar, he held up the mediation agreement. He said, no problem, we'll sign it tomorrow. And he did. So that, and he paid my lawyer's expenses well, which were a mere £60,000 compared with the £500,000 that the Arabs had run up. Great pity. Okay.
Once again, KB.
So they are. Interesting week.
Yes.
More revelations next week.
I'm sure there will be. KB, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. And good luck. Leeds against Everton, which is the first genuine test of the new setup, the new coach and the new squad. But good luck to them all.